I was just waiting for my wife to sit down so we could start.
I know, Heidi. I work with them all week. I know.
The rebels. We're going to start in Nehemiah chapter 6, if you'll go there in your Bible tonight. Nehemiah chapter 6. Great to see everybody. And if you detect some connecting threads between what Jeff and I talk about tonight and the lesson this morning, then that means we accomplished our purpose, because we're trying to overtly tie what we did this morning to what we talk about tonight. We want to begin with a couple of verses in Nehemiah 6, but they require a little context, right? It would help to know a little about the setting leading up to chapter 6.
Yeah. So, you know, the story of the Jews in the land in Nehemiah's day, of course, they've been allowed to return from exile, come back. By Nehemiah's point in the story, the temple's been rebuilt. And so there are some aspects of a return to normalcy for the Jews in Jerusalem. But they still don't have a wall, and so Nehemiah is either rebuilding the wall. But that arouses a lot of opposition. I think it's sometimes easy to remember when the Jews came back from exile. They never really possessed the land alone. You know, a lot of the folks who had come in during the period of their exile, some were settled in there by the powers, the imperial powers. And some folks just wandered there. But the bottom line is, it's not a homogenous Jewish land anymore. And so there were some folks in the land who really did not approve of the Jews rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And so there's a lot of pushback. There's a lot of hostility, threats, including legal threats, you know, taking things up with the Persian king. So it's a difficult and scary time for the Jews.
And then internal troubles too.
Well, yeah.
They had their own struggles among themselves the middle of all that.
You know, ironically, they've come back from exile for their sin. They rebuilt the temple, which required God expecting them to live a holy life. You know, they're going to rebuild and use his temple. But yeah, they themselves have not exactly been morally upright. And so there's a lot of headwinds that Nehemiah as a leader is facing in this season of rebuilding the wall. External opposition from the powers that be, legal threats, threats of physical violence, coupled with internal moral decadence among the Jews still.
And yet we get to chapter 6, and this is verse 15, if you look down there. In spite of all the difficulties they face pulling this off, verse 15 says, so the wall was completed on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. And 16 adds this further clarification, I think. When our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. And so, first of all, it isn't just a remarkably brief period of time to get this work done, but it was such an astonishingly brief period of time that even the unbelievers around them recognized,
right.
Yeah, they didn't pull this off on their own.
Right.
They had to have help
the
in doing
what
they...
The hand of God was involved.
Yeah. So I think typically when we study the book of Nehemiah, our focus is on this great accomplishment and don't always appreciate the sort of day-to-day work that was underneath it. If you back up a little bit to chapter 2, when he gets all of this started, there's this little note. Look at the end of verse 18. This is Nehemiah 2 and verse 18. He calls the people together and lays the challenge before them. And so they say, let us arise and build. And then there's this little note. So they put their hands to the good work. And so the nation comes together and they start building the wall. Then chapter 3 comes, right?
Right.
And chapter 3 is flyover territory. it's like a genealogy list. Look at verse 1. Then Eliashib the high priest arose with his brothers the priests and built the sheep gate, and they consecrated and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall of the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hanel. Verse 2, next to them the men of Jericho built. And so on and on this chapter goes for 32 verses, and that's what it is. Who worked?
Right.
and where they worked with very few variations of that. And so you read four or five verses and you realize, okay, this is the way it's going to go on for a while. And so we just tend to pass over this, forgetting that what this quantifies is what he said in verse 18. So they set their hands to the good work. And these are the people actually doing the work. This is why they were able to accomplish this great feat in 52 days. Why? Because everybody came together to do the work God wanted them to do on the wall.
Right, and I think that's why it's so important to appreciate the fact that a chapter like chapter 3 is in the Bible. God wanted us to know that even though it seems like Nehemiah gets all the headline, I mean, this portion of the Bible bears his name, and he's obviously kind of the central figure that God is working through to lead his people. The reality is God knows who these people are, and their work counts before God so much so that even though their name's mentioned once in the Bible, God wants you to know who these people were and the crucial role that they played in making the rebuilding of Jerusalem and its walls happen. That seemingly small efforts, seemingly small works by people who otherwise don't seem to change the course of history in the Bible or outside the Bible, in God's eyes, this stuff matters. And everybody's work is essential. You know, if you didn't build your section of the wall, that section of the wall doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And one of the reasons I think chapter 3 is here is because it reminds every generation who reads this story that God knew the names, the very names of the people. I counted them one time, and I forget now what I came up with, but I actually counted the number of names, just dozens and dozens of names that are listed here. God knows every single worker and what they're doing. So Jeff and I wanted y'all to think about that because the people of this generation, I think, serve as an example. Clearly, the Holy Spirit intended it to be so because of all the stories down through history that could have been included in God's book. God wanted this story in his book, and God wanted chapter 3 in his telling of the story of this book. And one of the reasons I think that it's valuable to us is because it serves as an inspiration to us as we ponder our own work that we need to do for the Lord. In fact, I would contend a more important work. I mean, I don't want to trivialize the building of the wall. That was a pretty big deal for them.
Right. No, I mean, ultimately, I mean, the whole, you know, move from the Old Testament to the New Testament in general is, you know, we move from the lesser to the greater. And the New Testament makes clear that, you know, physical Israel's experiences, their successes, their failures, are meant to be warnings or encouragements to us who are building the real temple of God, which is not a building in ancient Jerusalem. It is the church of God in this world. You know, our work in this local congregation is the rebuilding of the ruins, so to speak. Our work in this congregation is our share of participating in God's good work of rebuilding a place where God and man can dwell together in worship and reverence.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, a work that's ultimate end is helping people get to heaven.
Right.
And I mention that because it's what attaches true value to our work. The fact that beyond our death and beyond the end of this world as we know it, when we stretch into eternity, the work we do now is work that impacts eternity, that matters in eternity, unlike most of the earthly endeavors that we participate in. You've really got to be careful about that, right? Because because it can get pretty depressing to think about the end of your earthly endeavors. So what happens if you're working your job and you die? What happens? How long is it going to get them to take them to hire somebody else? And then how long it will be before nobody knew you even worked there. I mean, 4 or 5 years down the road, it's like, remember that guy?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And what is it that's being done? Maybe a hugely successful businessman. What happens when you die? Your kids fight over the company?
Yeah.
Or they just sell it and go on a cruise with your money? And one day your kids and your grandkids died, nobody will know that we were here. And someone says, wow, I came back tonight to listen to that?
Sounds like all something I'd say.
I do work in an office next to Jeff, and that is a problem. But the truth is, that's not a pessimistic view of life. If you think that's dark, it's because we're living in the light of an illusion. That is life. That is how life goes. And I think what's different about what we do that's related to the kingdom is it's work that you can ultimately say matters. And the cool thing, the other thing I would extract from this story is that there are a lot of different kinds of works that need to be done.
Yeah.
And you know, as they go to work on the wall, they're just all different kinds of people laboring in all different kinds of places. Everybody had their spot on the wall.
Right.
And I think the same thing is true when it comes to kingdom labors. Thank heaven we don't all do the same thing, that we have a variety of talents. The Bible figure is that the church is like a body. This is what, like 1 Corinthians 12?
Right.
And each piece of the body has a different function. And though we attach significance to some parts and not to other parts, at the end of the day, you may not pay as much attention to your foot as you do to your face, but you still need your foot.
Right.
And life without it's pretty miserable.
And I think part of what's useful to remember when we think about the image of the body of Christ as a physical body, that analogy Paul makes, is that God likes it this way. We tend to rank or kind of homogenize certain roles, certain works of service in the church are more glamorous or prestigious or important. You know, we rank the importance. But the reality is God delights in the body, the concept of the body. In other words, God delights in a diversity of people with a diversity of talents and abilities coming together in a unity of purpose. Just like our body, oh, God delights in the fact that our bodies are diverse parts, but they work to create one common life for the whole body. It's almost like the nature of God himself is, you know, kind of reflected in his creations, right? That mystery of one God in three persons. And God delights in making things that, we image him. You know, individually, certainly, but there's a sense in which even the church as a body of Christ, you know, images these ultimate, you know, God delights in a multiplicity of things that unite in a unity. And so it's something for us to think about. This is how God likes it.
Well, and how he designed it.
How he designed it.
This was his plan all along. Because part of all of this is that there are just lots of different things that need to be done. Have you ever just sat and pondered how many different ways it's possible to contribute to the work of the kingdom? I mean, if you just look around the church family here and think about all the different things that people do, how long is that list? And you talked about ranking the different works. How long has that been a problem?
Oh, wow.
Because in 1 Corinthians 12, that whole point is addressing people who thought
right.
speaking in tongues was the coolest gift.
Right.
And Paul says, I'm not even sure that's the coolest gift, but that's not even the thing that matters, right?
Right, right. That's not the thing that profits the most in a local assembly.
Yeah, and so I think we all fall into that trap of wanting to see some work as more important than other works, which the Bible should really clue us in on that. I think about, as you were talking, I was thinking about the story of Dorcas
mm-hmm.
in the book of Acts.
Right.
Remember her story? You know, she dies and her people are really concerned about that, and they send for Peter to come and to do something about that, right?
Right.
And do you know what Dorcas did? What her job was? She made undergarments for widows, poor people. Yeah, that'll get your name on CNN, right? That'll get your name mentioned in the news. Who was she? Tell you who she was. Someone whose labor mattered to God. And her name is in the Bible. And so I do think we tend to, even in our work together, glamorize certain works.
Right.
And I think typically those are works that are public. We kind of hold those up as being more important than others, like the guys that get lead singing for us, who do a fantastic job, right? If you don't know how blessed you are here with that, you don't travel enough. Because you get out and go some other places and you realize, wow, we are really blessed with the guys that we have back home, right? Very grateful for that. That's needful here. People glamorize preaching. I think preaching Sometimes you always get the sense people think that's the most important thing that goes on Sunday, or the people that staff these classes and serve as teachers and are working in that public way. Sometimes I think we unduly elevate those kinds of public aspects of service and don't appreciate just how much there is to do and how important so many other, I don't know, quiet works are going on.
But just as essential. And again, the body's analogy works so well. I mean, and that's part of the point Paul will make. You know, the face and the hands are obvious parts of the body, but the truth of the matter is my hands and my face don't do a whole lot if that, you know, if my lungs, which you can't even see, quit doing their job, or the heart. You know, or some of the less unpleasant bodily functions that we have to think about, but are crucial, absolutely crucial to the body's health. And so we do tend to rank, unfortunately, the more visible over the invisible, less visible, but in some ways more crucial.
Yeah.
I will live a lot longer without, you know, my hands or my feet than I will without my intestines. Though it's not pleasant to think about what the intestines do, but it's crucial. It's crucial. And so, yeah, we get the priorities and the perspective all backwards.
Let's dig down into that a little bit. Have you ever thought about the quiet works going on that we often don't notice that are just so important? I think that maybe one at the top of my list is the work of evangelism. You know, we often describe evangelism as the work of the church, and I think that's true. I think churches contribute in some ways to the work of helping us get the message to the lost people, but I think evangelism is largely an individual work that's quietly done. I mean, I don't know when any of you are talking to your coworkers or your neighbors, unless you share that with me. Sometimes I talk with folks about that, but a lot of that stuff just quietly goes on and nobody knows about it. I don't know about everybody that's having a Bible study with a coworker they connected with or a neighbor they've been talking to. Occasionally it comes up, but I don't know about that. When do we know about evangelistic work, typically? When someone gets baptized, right? And that's the whole iceberg issue. There was a whole bunch of other stuff going on underneath the surface to get to the point of baptism. And we may not have even known that any of that was going on before that moment when someone obeys the gospel. I think about people who are quiet encouragers. Some of you do that job, right? You pay attention. You notice people that are struggling. There are some folks that are just way better at that than I am.
Right.
I'm probably guilty of being better at being oblivious than I am at noticing.
Right. Or just knowing what to say that's really helpful, as opposed to sometimes we, you know.
I'm terrible at that.
Yeah.
Like when you go to the hospital, I just usually fumble around till I say something like, I hope you don't die.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you want me to come, right? Yeah, you're thinking, when I'm in the hospital, yeah, just stay home, David. Yeah. I'm good. It's awkward, right?
Yeah, don't lead with I've seen worse.
But have you ever hung around with someone who knew just what to say? Who just had the words?
Yeah.
I had a preacher friend who was really good at that until I discovered, after visiting hospitals with him for a while, he just gave everybody the same speech. Just reused it over and over again. But there are people who are really good at identifying hurting folks and really good at knowing the right things to say. How much do we know about that? I think that just goes on in the background and largely is unnoticed. We just kind of see the fruit of it when it begins to be born. How much publicity does that kind of work get? And I think it's some of the most important work going on among us. Some of you are writers. I used to, you know, going back now more than a decade, I used to get cards periodically for people that would comment on things that I had preached. No cards anymore. Well, a few cards occasionally.
Text
messages. Text. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. People will text and express gratitude for something that's been preached or taught. Are you in that crowd? We ought to say this more often than we do. That is hugely encouraging.
Right.
When you do things like that. So if you're one of these people that just sends an encouraging word to your kid's Bible class teacher, that's kingdom work, folks. That blesses people, that lifts them up, encourages them to do more.
Right. And there's a force multiplier, ironically, because when you encourage somebody who's you know, touching other lives, I mean, just literally your encouragement of one person will bear fruit with other people that are helped by a teacher, a preacher, a Bible class, you know, teacher, and it's good stuff.
Don't text me something right now, okay? Peter's just sitting over there and talking about the texting. I know is just baiting him. I want to mention one other thing. We'll move on to something else. But I think about the folks, and we've got folks here who are just great at this, who stand back in the lobby and greet people when they come in. And if you don't know how that important is, you probably don't visit very much. I won't ask you to raise your hands, but you could just sort of knowingly nod if you've had a bad visitor experience. Yes. You've been someplace and people kind of stared at you like you might be a terrorist when you came in the door. Have y'all had that experience? And nobody talked to you. It's like he might be an enemy. We got to keep our eye on him. You've had that experience? Visiting churches. And I'm embarrassed to say this. Has this ever happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's better if they know you've come to preach sometimes.
Sometimes it makes it worse, actually.
Yeah, sometimes. But if you're just a stranger walking in, and I'm embarrassed because it's my brethren, but it motivates me. We got to do better about that. We got to help people feel welcome.
That's the thing. People don't realize. A lot of times folks decide whether they're going to come back if they've been visiting, not based on how good the service was or the preaching and the teaching, but whether they felt like they could fit in here because somebody actually acknowledged their existence in this building. That matters as much as whatever goes on publicly.
Was anyone nice to me?
Exactly. Did anyone even notice me?
Yep. So I really, this list could go on. Jeff and I could just sit here and chat tonight about all the different facets of this work. But I definitely want to mention the tech guys because I want to have sound throughout the whole thing, right? I wish we had a way of just recording for you guys the activity that goes on here while y'all aren't here. Because we're here all the time, right? There are so many people that come up here and work on so many different things. Teachers that come up here and work, and the people who are responsible for the slide and the sound and the lights and the website and all those things, that information you can get there. And the maintenance guys that come and fix something. You know, it's literally, I'm driving to the building today and seeing where there have been trees down, and I'm thinking, oh, I wonder if anything happened at the building. Aren't you glad you didn't find that out when you got here this morning, like there had been a tree through the roof or something? There are actually people who look for those kind of things and check on those things. And those are kingdom labors. That's contributing to this work that we're trying to do together.
Even down to the smallest things that nobody ever thinks of, like those who come by and pick up the towels and the garments after we baptize somebody and make sure they're washed and back. That just has all sorts of good things going on constantly like that around the building.
Well, so here's the point about that. I think we need to see all that as valuable. And so there are a lot of things to do. Remember that everybody got named that was working on the wall, wherever they were, whatever they were doing, their work.
They're on God's list.
They're on God. That's exactly right. And so there's a place for you to be involved. There's a work that you can do. And God knows you're doing it, and it matters to him. One of the reasons Jeff and I really want to emphasize this is because sometimes I've had people say this now. Several times over the years, people come to a congregation this size, and you know what they say? Well, I wouldn't be needed there. There wouldn't be anything for me to do. And when people say that to me, I want to be nice, but sometimes what I want to say is, are you kidding me? Work doesn't go down as the numbers rise. You doubt that? Ask the shepherds about that.
Ask the deacons.
Ask the deacons about that. work goes up exponentially with the size of the family.
Right.
Right?
Right. When you had more kids, it got easier, right? There was less to do because you had more kids to help out doing their own chores. That's how it works, right? Now, we know better than
that. I really don't know about that. I only had two, Jeff, so I don't. Yes. Man on man, never zone offense at our defense at our house. But I think that's probably coming from a place where we're thinking too much about public stuff.
We're back to that ranking, the visible is the important. And
if you want a lead singer here, it's you maybe once a month, right?
There's a rotation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not as bad as it used to be when I used to go here before you were here. What like once every 6 months? I think that's what it was at one time. Yeah. Guys got to lead once every 6 months.
Right.
So yeah, maybe not that stuff.
Right.
But that doesn't mean there isn't.
Right.
Lots of stuff.
Right.
So remember, it's not for our glory, but for His. Which kind of brings us to a second thing I think we need to talk about. And that is, with all this stuff to do and a place for all of us, to get to the place where that work's getting done, we really need to have that servant spirit. We want to think about that a little bit tonight. We just read something recently in John that I think was vivid about that. So when you look at John 13, remember this story? So this is John's Lord's Supper story.
Right. This is how he differs than the other Gospels.
Yeah, he doesn't tell the story like the Gospels does. So set this up a little bit for us. Where are we and what's about to happen?
Well, I mean, he's about to be crucified. I mean, that's, you know, unique to John's gospel. He just spends, John tells us a lot more about the conversation and the teaching Jesus gave his disciples that night of the Last Supper at more length. And but chapter 13 is kind of the beginning of the evening. And literally, you know, when he knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world into the Father. You know, that's where we're at. You know, Jesus knows that this is the final evening. And so it's significant. If you knew that this was your final evening with your family, you know, right before you're going to die, you're going to be taken from this world, what would you do? Well, you'd probably tell your kids whatever you'd not gotten around to telling them yet, or tell your spouse whatever you'd not gotten around to telling them yet, especially if you were worried about your children or your spouse and what they might do or the situations they might be in when you were gone. You'd talk to them about what you expect to come in life and what you hope they do with it. So it's all the more telling when you think about this story from that angle. Jesus knows things will never be the same again with his disciples after this night. There'll be a resurrection and he'll get some time with them, but it won't be like these years of the ministry. Things will never be the same again. He knows his time is up with him. So what do you say and what do you do? And he washes their feet. Because he says, you know, not just one, you know, Jesus wasn't just about telling people, he was about showing them what it means to be human and what God does for us. And so it's from that standpoint that the God of the universe, robed in human flesh, as the perfect human being, combining both roles in a sense as the perfect human and as God himself, shows what it means to be God and to bear the image of God. He chooses to wash feet. He chooses to serve. And he does it the most lowly way possible, right? We get this. This was, you know, the equivalent of one of those really nasty, dirty jobs in the ancient world. This was low social status. This was for the lowest and newest and youngest slave in the household to get. Even the older, more mature slaves or those who had some rank. You know, this was above even them. This was the epitome of getting on your knees, wrapping himself in a towel. You know, the God who can be anything, do anything, have anything, wrapping himself in a towel. To wash filthy feet in a world in which, you know, the streets were the sewers. The animals dropped their dung, people threw their refuse out. You know, no telling what's on these feet after a day's wandering. And the God of the universe and the perfect human being chooses to wash feet as the greatest symbolic act in some ways of what his, well, the greatest act is the crucifixion, but the actual giving of his life, but it's an extremely symbolic act of what it means to really be God and to bear the image of God.
So he's doing this not just from a random collection of people either.
No, these are his people. These are his handpicked, by name, chosen 12.
And they know.
That's right.
They know who he is. Yep. And Peter seems to get that, right? Because you know his reaction. If you go down to verse six, when he gets to Peter, of course Peter's going to be the one to speak up.
Right.
And Peter says, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" And I think Jesus knows where he's going with this. And he says, "What I do, you do not realize, but you'll understand after." And notice Peter's response. "Never shall you wash my feet." From one angle, he gets it, right?
Right, right.
This isn't the way this ought to be.
Right.
You're God. We should be washing your feet, not the other way around. Which, by the way, the opportunity that for existed at the beginning of the evening.
That's right.
Any one of them could have done it.
The feet had not been washed.
Yes. Which is really nasty when you realize they're eating, reclining and eating. And so from one angle, Peter gets it, or does he?
Well, that's the thing is, you know, like so many of the other cases where they can confess he's the Messiah, but not fully understand the implications of the Messiah and what it means to be the Messiah. You know, he certainly is thinking more, I would expect, on the earthly level. You know, a king, you know, who's going to reign on the throne of David, most likely here in Jerusalem. So, yeah, there's still that earthly, it's beneath you, but for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
You know, not because you don't do this in heaven, but because kings don't do this on earth.
So, to me, the linchpin in all of this is 12 through 15.
Right.
Will y'all look at that? "So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said, 'Do you know what I have done to you?'" What's the answer to that question? No. They are just at a loss for what's happened. 13 says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you ought also to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should also do as I did to you." So 13 is interesting to me. You call me teacher and Lord, and that's who I am. Jesus knew who he was. And the act of washing their feet changed nothing about who he is, right? In fact, it's because he knows who he is that he is able to stoop to this lowly position,
right,
and to serve his disciples in this way. Why? Because he needed to teach them this lesson. Remember, even in this very night, they've been battling about who's the greatest. Who's going to be on the right? Who's going to be on the left? Who's going to have the better positions? And if they didn't come together on that, the mess they would have had trying to go out and do his work after that. And so Jesus uses this dramatic demonstration without a word initially.
Right.
To teach them this powerful lesson about their role as humble servants. It's interesting that we don't read about them fussing about who's the greatest.
No, it's hard to come back from this one.
I think you're changed when God washes your feet.
Well, and I think there's part of it too, you know, that's worth knowing. It comes from a little bit later in the chapter, and this, and where you see it here in chapter 13, it's certainly not the only place in John's gospel, in particular, this kind of sentiment is written down, which is this: Jesus isn't worried about how they receive it or how they notice it as such for its own sake either. In fact, you go back to verse 2, John wants to make sure we realize Judas is in the group as well. He's serving needs not just for people who deserve it or people who do right by him or say, "Thank you, I appreciate that." You know, he's also washing the feet of the man who's going to betray him to his death in a few hours, and he knows it. But when you drop down the verse, you know, was it about...
I had to really wash those feet too.
Yeah, that's right.
Like with some good hard brush.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But verse 31, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. And if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself. At the end of the day, you know, what Jesus recognizes is you do this because this is the will of God, and you do this because God is glorified in this. And I think that also helps us to really, again, reevaluate our works of service, whether they're public or private, whether they're noticed or unnoticed, whether they're appreciated or unappreciated, how they rank in the world's social ranking of prestige or importance, relative importance of the things that we do. At the end of the day, we're literally back to the same concept of Nehemiah. God notices my works, what I think they're significant or insignificant. The cup of cold water given in his name does not go unnoticed. And at the end of the day, Jesus just simply says, what's going on here this night and what's going on in the coming hours? What's already happened when I washed feet? The Father is glorified. And that's where, at the end of the day, every time you do something for righteousness' sake, you have to remind yourself whether the person deserves it or not, whether they notice it or not, whether I'm thanked or not, whether the elders notice, anybody notices or not. God's writing the story at the end of the day, not your brethren. And God's writing down names and places on the wall and who did what when it needed to be done. And God is glorified in that. And that's what keeps us, I hope, motivated at the end of the day. Jesus goes through this night. He remembers this is all about the Father's glory and what's happening and what I'm doing.
Yeah, someone actually posed a question
about,
how do these quiet acts of service get commended if they're just quiet acts of service and nobody toots their own horn, so to speak? How do those acts of service get noticed? And part of the answer to that is, it is noticed. Yeah. It's noticed by God. And at the end of the day, in the labors we do for the kingdom, for all of us, that needs to be enough. God knows what I'm doing. God values my work.
And to tag on to that, usually we think about the day of judgment primarily in negative terms, when sin will be punished and people will be sent to hell. And maybe, sometimes some of us at different seasons of life, or maybe when we know that we've got some compromises in our lives that the Lord certainly is aware of and our conscience is bugging us about. We think about the day of judgment in one sense, in a certain fearful sense, because I don't want my sins exposed. I don't want God to hold me accountable for sins that maybe I've been tolerating or whatnot. But you realize the day of judgment works both ways. That's when literally our lives are laid bare. The unfortunate parts that maybe we need to be repenting of before that day comes. But listen, the day of judgment is also when the good deeds that we have done that maybe have gone unnoticed by people in this life, but God has noticed, those deeds will be declared in the last days. Well, we forget that the day of judgment swings both ways. That door goes both ways. Mm. And that the works that I've done for God and for good, because it's right, and for God's glory, those days will be noticed and declared by God. Just like in the Bible, we see names of people working on the wall. Names that you skipped over perhaps when you were reading because that's boring. It won't be boring in the last day when it's God who's reading from the throne the names and all the deeds that we've done. It's certainly motivation to get rid of the negative stuff in there, but it ought to be motivation for the fact that what matters is God knows, and God will declare before heaven and earth and the angels in the last day what I have done on his behalf for his glory. That ought to motivate us.
The other way the work is noticed is by those who are blessed from the work. And it does point up, I think, the value of gratitude. If an act of service is quietly done for me, I need to be the one to acknowledge and be grateful. And if God knows about it, the person served is grateful, there you go.
Right.
That's my blessing in all of that. We wanted to bring up the spirit of Jesus here because it is the spirit that we too need to adopt, the humble spirit of Jesus. I think that maybe one of the most important character traits of people who serve is that spirit of humility that starts out by recognizing that I'm in the same boat with the rest of humanity. I'm a sinner that needs rescue, right?
Right.
And so whatever I achieve, wherever I'm at in my life, in the way that matters, I'm no better than anybody else, right? And I'm not above any other task. And I say that because sometimes pride gets in our way.
Oh, 100%.
Right?
Yeah.
Years ago, when I was first started preaching, we had a work day. Do y'all remember work days at the building? Like the weekend before a meeting, everybody would come up and spruce the building up for the meeting. We had a guy that just wouldn't do that. And he talked to me about it one time. He just said, I just think we can pay people to do that. And I thought, here's this guy who has abundant world possessions, has a very powerful position, and he doesn't know who he is. A sinner desperately needing rescue, just like everybody else. Too good to clean toilets, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't know who he is. It's never about the task, folks. It's about the cause. What needs to be done, and can I do it to help the kingdom, right? Now, the fun part of this is that we also have to be available. And this is where Jesus starts messing with your life, right? Because, would you raise your hand if you sit around all day with nothing to do? Because we can put some things on your list for you. Did you see any hands?
No.
No, see, I didn't either. We all got plenty to do, right? And if kingdom labors are going to fit, then I gotta make some sacrifices, right?
Well, and I think that's the thing we forget. Sometimes we think about service as an act of money and generosity, perhaps. And there's certainly a place for that, and money is necessary in life, no doubt about it. But here's the reality. You can always get more money. You keep working, there will be another paycheck. What can you not get back once it's spent? Time. Time is the measure of our lives. Literally, you stop and think about it. Time is how we measure life. You know, how long did somebody live? They lived to be 76, they lived to be 84, lived to be 92. Time is how we literally measure the quantity of life. You measure money in dollars and cents. You measure life in time. And so when I spend my time in service, what I'm literally doing is I'm giving my life. I'm spending an unrecoverable part of my life doing something for somebody else, doing something for the cause of Christ, doing something for God's glory. I think that's why sometimes we'd rather write the check, because I can always get more money. There'll be another payday, Lord willing, but I don't get this Saturday back. I don't get this week back. I don't get these hours back. I might get more money down the road, and that's why I'd rather write the check and keep my time. And so, yeah, there isn't this issue of availability, of just having to be inconvenienced. Change my plans sometimes, depending on the need that comes up or arises that's got my name on it.
Yeah.
That's where the rubber meets the road about this stuff.
I think sometimes we're short-sighted, and our focus is on the moments, the days and weeks and the months, and not thinking of the big picture. What are you going to do at work next week that matters in the big picture? Labor for a business that'll one day close, right? I'm not trying to trash your work. I mean, it's good you got a job and it pays you money. It helps you with some responsibilities you have before God. But at the end of the day, folks, what are you doing that matters beyond death and the grave? And one of the beautiful things about being a disciple is the fact that God offers to us a path through life that ultimately does have meaning and purpose. We are doing things that impact eternity. Stuff that really does in the end matter. And so I think you got to kind of weigh that out. I know we have to work jobs and provide for our families and do all those things. I know we need to get our kids through school and school activities are great. But at the end of the day, what will any of us do in our lives that rise to a higher importance than our kingdom labors and helping people get to heaven? It really does help a real significance attach to our lives when we spend them on kingdom labors.
Right. And I do think what's important to say as time's starting to get short here is this, depending on how you're thinking about stuff we've been talking about tonight, is that this is not, tonight Dave and I didn't intend this to be kind of a guilt trip, guilt session intervention, something like that. Receive what we're doing here tonight in this spirit. Number one, if you're already busy and you're saying, man, I'm already busy and I'm exhausted and I'm tired and I can't believe you're talking about service, see this as an encouragement that your work does matter. See it as an encouragement and motivation to stay at it when you're tired. See it as an encouragement and appreciation that even if sometimes your brethren don't notice, God is noticing. And so see it and receive it as encouragement that your work matters. Stay at it. The day is coming when we do get the rest from our labors. But that what you're doing really is important, whether you think it is or not, or you're getting worn out. And the other thing is to perhaps encourage and motivate those who maybe aren't as involved but could be, perhaps. Somebody who could rearrange their priorities in a way that allows them to be more active and involved. To think about that. To think about where you do want to invest your time, because your time, again, is the measure of your life. Where do you want to invest the essence of your life when all is said and done? And especially when the great day of the Lord comes and names are read and books are open and the descriptions of how we've spent our life is given. Not just the good stuff, but you want to, you think about this, in the last day, you want God to be able to, in one sense, lay out, not for your own glory, but for His glory, you know, the list of things that you've been able to accomplish from this life, things that may not rank by the world standards, even by your brethren's standards sometimes as much. But in the last day, you want God to be able to open the books and read not just the negative stuff you've done, but read the positive for heaven and earth, the contributions you've made to the cause. When that day comes, you want your name read in that way as well.
I thought it was interesting. One of the questions that came into us tonight was, what do I actually say to someone who appears to be discouraged or disheartened? You know, what? How do you go up and have that conversation? How do you start? What kind of things do you say? And one of the things I love about that question is because whoever asked that's thinking, okay, I'd like to serve in that way, not really sure I know how to do it. And so I'm glad you're thinking about that. And the other thing is it identifies one of the obstacles, right? Sometimes the thing that keeps me from serving is I don't know. I don't know if I'll be good at this. I don't know how to do it. So a couple of things about that. I would encourage you to test the waters. Not sure you can do it? Try. With regard to that specific question, I think sometimes we try too hard to be artful. And I think just honest and from the heart probably is the better way to go, even if it isn't the most perfect way to say it. Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying? Hey, I was looking at you and you really looked like you were discouraged today, and that concerned me. If that's what you're thinking, say that. And let them tell you what they need. Another piece of that, just to run that trail a little further, is we need to quit putting on fronts for each other too, right? Because sometimes things are not okay, but you're never going to know it because I'm going to keep my front up. You're going to think everything is okay. And it's kind of hard to serve when we don't know, even when you can tell, but that front is still up.
And just to add on to that, here's the reality. Don't make the perfect the enemy of the good in your service.
Yeah.
Don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And what I mean by that is, you know what? Most folks who you try to help in some way or reach out to, they appreciate the honesty, the authenticity, and the effort more than the perfection. You know, at the end of the day, the fact that you brought food matters more than how good the food was. The fact that the brother or sister in Christ cared enough to notice and to do something, you know, so whatever it is, the reality is your brothers and sisters will appreciate simply the fact that you noticed and you made the effort more than you did it as well as somebody else in the past who's helped them out. Authenticity, genuine care and concern is really what service is about anyways, not how well the service was done. And so don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Just love and care and reach out to somebody in your life, you know, and do something for somebody when you can. That's where the rubber meets the road.
I want to tag on to what Jeff said earlier. It really was not our purpose to load you up with a guilt trip and make you feel bad if you don't feel like you're doing enough. Do we ever do enough? Are we ever going to get to that place where we say that? But this enterprise we're involved in, folks, is the most important thing anyone is doing on the face of the earth. And I think our desire is for everyone to have a meaningful part in that. It'll bless you. And so, you know, if you're on the back end of life and you're struggling to walk, there's a way for you to be involved in the enterprise. And you guys that are sitting over here and not sure how you can get involved, there's a part for you in all of this. And our desire is that everyone who's a member of the Kleinwood Church has a meaningful part in the work that we're doing together. If you're struggling with that, this church has shepherds who keep the sheep here, and they would love to help you find your place in this family.